My name is Arnold Evans, and I graduated from the law school in Darden in 97. Since that time, I've been an investment banker in equity capital markets the entire time frame. In New York for several of those years, now in Atlanta, and I run an equity capital markets group, which is focused on helping clients, corporate clients, get access to public equity dollars, either through the form of IPOs, follow-ons, equity-linked transactions, otherwise known as converts, and sometimes private equity investments into public equity. And what I'd like to talk about this afternoon, and you guys hopefully have the material, for probably about the next 30 minutes or so, and I want to give you the opportunity to ask some questions, is what's going on in the IPO market today, the implications of the slowdown, and I want to throw out a few ideas about what we might do to help the market work again. And when I say what we might do, I mean what government and others might be able to do. Some of you are probably asking, what does this have to do with the credit crisis? The fact is that the equity markets are very closely connected to the results and the performance of the credit markets. Put simply, if companies can't get access to bank capital, they have a very difficult time keeping the lights on and operating on a day-to-day basis, which means their performance suffers, which means their earnings suffer, which means it all translates, if you're a public company, into the way that public investors think about you and how your stock would trade on a day-to-day basis. Now, I'd love to be able to say that after the last presentation, I could come in with a more optimistic tone. And in fact, when I created the Ghostbuster-esque slide on page two at the beginning of the week, I was thinking that I actually might be able to say that this isn't true anymore, that the IPO market is working. On Monday of this week, there were four deals on the calendar that were scheduled to get priced this week, raising probably $1.5 billion. There was a Mead Johnson deal. That company is known for Enfamil, which is a 100-year-old brand, and anyone who's got kids or has friends with small kids will know that is an infant formula product. The other companies, and by the way, Mead Johnson was successful this week, so that's the first IPO that's been completed in the U.S. market since November of last year, and they raised roughly $700 million. There were three other deals. One deal, which by a company by the name of O'Gara Group, which has the infamy of making armored cars, including Mercedes-Benzes. As I was talking to Chip McDonald on the way up earlier today, those cars are particularly useful in Latin America and the Middle East, but not many other places. That deal has not gotten priced and is going to be pushed off. It was a company by the name of Madison Capital, which is a mortgage REIT, basically a finance company. There are no finance companies getting priced. I'm not sure why the underwriters tried. So that didn't get priced. The third company was called Changing World Technologies, which happens to be the name of a biodiesel company. Again, it did not get priced, pushed off into the future at some point in time when they find the markets more hospitable. So unfortunately, where we are today is still where where slide number two is. This is reality. The IPO market, for all practical purposes, is not working. Now, before I give you some context on what it means for the IPO market not to work and how it doesn't, how badly it's not working today relative to some historical perspective, I want to provide a little bit of background vocabulary so that we can be on the same sheet of music in terms of just understanding the factors that affect the public equity market. On page three, what I've outlined quickly is one component of the public equity market. And I've broken it into two simple components. This is the secondary market. This is what you see if you turn on CNBC and they show the lines trading and the all the scrolling information that talks about where stocks are trading, where the major indices are trading. And obviously this goes back a very long time to the early 90s. That spike in the middle around 99 to 2001 is NASDAQ peaking up around the tech boom and then the tech bust. And I've highlighted on this page a handful of factors that affect the secondary market. First and foremost, you need to know that it's simple supply and demand. If you want to buy a share and I want to sell a share, it's a question of where we agree on price. Now, this all happens electronically. It happens very fast. And there are thousands of people like me and you out there, both individual investors, known as retail, and institutional investors, whether they're mutual funds, hedge funds, or other corporate-type entities. But that's the simple dynamic that drives the individual price and the trading activity on a day-to-day basis in the secondary market. Now, of course, there are a series of factors that can drive your interest to buy, my interest to sell, and where we may be willing to do that. You've got individual reports that are associated with a company. Because below these indices are individual companies, the S&P 500, there are 500 companies. So it could be an earnings report, it can be an announcement of an M&A merger that the company might be making, or an acquisition the company might be making, and the pending results that we might anticipate from that. It could be the retirement of a senior executive or the untimely departure of a senior executive. You've got broader economic factors, whether it's the interest rate environment, whether it's unemployment. These are things that we're hearing a lot about today. So you've got those economic factors, including the big elephant in the room, the credit crisis, certainly has an impact on the secondary market. You also have geopolitical events, which I would narrow down. The most simple one to describe is war. Anytime you've got warlike events in the world, specifically when they involve the major countries and major economic markets, there's an impact. Obviously, 9/11 would have fallen under that category. Those dots would probably lead to things like CNBC-type reports, where whether we like it or not, the market does respond to things like that. And it may not be a company-specific event. It may not be a broader economic factor. It may just be some commentator, some knowledgeable commentator, making a speech about his or her perspective on a particular issue. You know, Wilbur Ross deciding that he wants to get in and buy financials for it to have a substantial impact on the market. By the way, it is worth noting that while the secondary market, as I'm describing it, is laid out and includes only common stock activity, you do have a series of other securities out there that trade that in a secondary market, whether they're fixed income securities like bonds, the warrants that were mentioned earlier, depending on the company, there may, in the scale of warrants outstanding, there may be a trading market in warrants. And you have equity-linked securities, otherwise known as converts, that sometimes do trade. If you flip to page 4, you get the other half of the market, the equity market that I want to talk about, and it is known as the primary market or the new issue market. The new issue market is best characterized by organized and coordinated offerings where new money is raised from investors. Typically, new shares are issued from the company, and typically there are equity proceeds coming to the corporate entity for some business objective, whether it's reducing debt, facilitating an acquisition, or just facilitating organic growth. Now, you could have secondary issuers. You may have a management team that owns a lot of shares that also in the or a financial sponsor in the context of an organized transaction selling shares. And that would absolutely be included here. But the fact is the vast majority of activity that happens in the primary market is proceeds coming to the company. Importantly, these offerings, almost without exception, occur with substantial legal documentation. In the case of an IPO, you're talking about an S-1 for domestic issuers. In the case of a follow-on offering, you're talking about an S-3 or prospectus supplement. In the case of an equity-linked transaction, you're talking about some form of offering memorandum as well. So that documentation occurs. There are underwriters, investment banks, involved in the vast majority of these transactions. And the process is regulated highly by the SEC for everything except for equity-linked transactions. So I think one question that I wanted to make sure that I got on the table or addressed here is, if you lay out what the equity market includes before we talk about IPOs in specific, and by the way, I guess I should tell you what you're looking at. This is total issuance volume, IPOs and follow-ons combined. You see the lines, the diamonds are IPO, the number of IPOs in each year. The squares are the number of follow-ons in each year. There's a fair question as to how the primary and secondary markets interact with one another. And the best analogy I've been able to come up with is the secondary market is like a river. It's constantly flowing all the time. It may be flowing at a fast pace, it may slow down at certain times. The level may rise, the level may fall. But the secondary market, like the river, is always flowing. And there are tributaries that come in and go out, but it's always flowing. The primary market is kind of like rain. Sometimes it rains hard. That might be Google going public, and for an extended period afterwards, exploding in terms of their stock price performance. Sometimes there's a light mist. We talked about Mead Johnson. I described Mead Johnson as a light mist because though that deal was successful, it's more of a GDP growth type company. And we'll talk about the importance of growth versus a Google, where everyone expected it. And for an extended period, it did grow extremely rapidly. Mead Johnson was more like a mist, lightly fell in to the river and proceeded at the pace of the river. At some point in time, every primary transaction has a way of flowing to the pace of the river, but that's the way I've best been able to think about it. The constant flow being the secondary market, the new entry into that flow being IPOs. And by the way, if I was to use that comparison and talk about the O'Gara deal, you know, the bulletproof car deal, it probably was like an errant raindrop that evaporated before it hit the river, since it didn't hit the river. So that's an idea about how what the secondary and the primary markets are and how they interact with each other. So I want to talk more about the IPO market specifically. And on page 5, particularly, how bad is the current IPO drought? On page 5, what we did was we went back to 92 and laid out all IPO volume within the U.S. So this is all transactions that were priced on NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange. You see the dollar volume of those transactions, and again, you see that 99, 2000, 2001 period where the technology boom occurred. And you see the number of transactions that occurred, and clearly the number of transactions varied substantially. You can see that from a median perspective, you're talking about $32, $33 billion of dollar volume every year. Though the number of deals per year isn't there, it's roughly 200 IPOs as a median. The bubbles are periods where there were multi-year slowdowns. And I highlighted 2008 because of my expectations, unfortunately, for 2009. So what you see in 2008, in terms of the number of deals, was a dramatic decline in terms of the number of transactions, roughly 30 transactions were completed. From a dollar volume perspective, it actually looks pretty good, but what you have to account for is the Visa transaction, which was roughly $20 billion in 2008.
Visa out, you're below $10 billion in issuance volume, which is below anything on this chart, actually closer to 1991. So the question is, how bad is the IPO market right now? I think that it's fair to say that from a historic perspective, it's pretty challenging. Now, if you flip the page, I can put that in the context of those periods where we saw other slowdowns occurring. And there were three prior multi-year slowdowns within that time frame going back to 92. And I guess I should tell you that if you go back beyond 92, it's really hard to get data. And the fact is, the number and scale of transactions was much, much lower. So we are talking about, contemporary times in the period in time when we've seen the most active markets. There's an interesting point that comes off this page, and I'll highlight it for you. It's that in every one of these periods, the event that triggered the slowdown in the IPO markets was a relatively discrete event, and it really didn't have a material impact in terms of activity for an extended period of time. Yes, the markets might have declined for a couple of years. Activity might have been slow at a particular moment in time, a particular month, but you didn't see multi-month periods. The message that I would traditionally give to the CEO or CFO who's considering an IPO is, you want to get prepared as soon as possible. You may have to wait a moment, but don't worry. The market doesn't close, because historically, that has been true. And if it does close, it only closes for a moment in time. The 94-95 time frame, you see 1 month, January of 95, where activity truly fell off a ledge. Very much connected to the peso devaluation and Mexican currency crisis, where the U.S. government ultimately came in and helped Mexico. It was a material problem for Mexico. It was a momentary problem for us, but from an IPO market perspective, no major challenges. 97-98, there were a series of events that occurred in the beginning of 97. There was the Asian financial or currency crisis, when a series of Asian currencies were shorted, which ultimately became an issue for the Russians and developed into a Russian financial crisis. Spreading into 98, and by the end of 98, where the real decline occurred in terms of IPO volume, what you had was long-term capital management virtually blowing up and shutting down pretty much everything on top of the Russian financial crisis. Again, it looks like in terms of the volume, there was a lighter number of deals in October of 98, but that was a fast bottom, and the market recovered and continued to go. The 2002-2003 period, there were a series of things that developed in 2001, and by the way, the reason I didn't include 2001 here is because 2001 volumes, believe it or not, were actually okay and relatively stable until you got to 9/11. And in September of 2001, the IPO market shut down. But in October of 2001, it was back again. A single discrete event. Over 2002 and 2003, what we had was the development of a recession, development and recovery from a recession. We had a series of events that could be described as corporate malfeasance, with Enron blowing up, WorldCom blowing up, Adelphia blowing up, the Arthur Andersen trial. And that had a material impact on top of the recession that had developed and we were trying to break out of in terms of driving the IPO market down. The issue there was that investors didn't have confidence in their ability to trust the numbers that they were being given, particularly because Arthur Andersen was complicit or viewed as being complicit in the Enron scenario. So if you look at 2007 to current activity, again, just to put this in context, you can see, and some of the prior speakers have talked about the series of events on the credit side that led to this, but you can see the material decline and sustained decline at the end of 2008. Specifically in November of 2008, Grand Canyon Education, which is an online affiliate of the university in Arizona, I think the University of Arizona, was able to get a $150 million deal done in November of last year. That was the only transaction in the late part of last year. And again, Mead Johnson just got done earlier this week. So between September of 2008 and current, there have been only two IPOs that have been completed. So for historical context, again, this is much more substantial in terms of slowdown than anything that we have historically seen. So the fair question is, why is this bad? And in order to talk about that, I need to take a couple steps backward and talk about why companies even think about going public. Page 7 is actually a pretty standard page that we show to entrepreneurs who have companies that they are considering taking down the IPO path. And it just lays out for them all the things that they may want to consider if they might want to go down this path. And the fact is they have alternatives, whether they go public or sell a company or just retain it as a private entity. The first reason that companies go public, first and foremost, is capital for growth. And I highlighted that issue along with the requirements for IPO, solid operating history, and attractive growth or attractive prospects, because the key factor there is growth. Companies often want to facilitate growth. Investors in most IPOs are looking for growth. Mead Johnson aside, investors are looking for growth. Now, the secondary point, and I'll highlight why that's important in a few minutes. The second reason that companies often go public is to strengthen their balance sheet. The fact is, and I'll show you some details here momentarily about how companies think about growing their life cycle and how they finance that. At the end of the day, you want to use the credit markets to the extent that you can to grow a business. Equity is the most precious asset that any small company has. They want to dole it out in the smallest pieces necessary, but to the extent that they can raise bank capital or other debt, they want to do it. The problem is banks and other credit-related investors aren't so enthusiastic about loading a company up all the time. We back into that GM story that we were discussing a few minutes ago. Particularly if you're talking about a smaller company that's considering going public, investors are often interested, and certainly banks are often interested, in ensuring that you've got a sufficient level of capital, equity capital, beneath the company. So two dynamics here in terms of why you would go public: providing capital for growth and strengthening the balance sheet. And importantly, investors want growth when they're thinking about participating in an IPO. So, go right in. Visa is another exceptional story. And if you look down that list for why companies go public, you find other tools. One of the important tools, one of the important reasons, actually, there are multiple, because I can tell you Visa's strategy. Acquisition currency, they did want to use stock to buy up smaller businesses as opposed to putting cash out, believe it or not. Liquidity for shareholders, primarily. Visa was owned by a series of banks. My employer was one of those banks that historically owned a large stake in Visa, they decided that it was desirable to get out. There were also some legal issues surrounding Visa because of its operating model and its interaction with peers, MasterCard, American Express, the IPO was also a tool to raise capital to facilitate any settlement that needed to be paid. So that was the easiest way of dealing with it, as opposed to all these owners writing checks and putting on the capital or putting it on the balance sheet. They decided that the company was highly valued in the public market, based on MasterCard's valuation. And if that's important, MasterCard, secondary market trading company, showing what a company like Visa, which was much, much larger, growing at a much, much faster pace, should be valued at. And that's why they decided to put themselves out there. Again, while Visa is, and I'll highlight this in a few moments with some other statistics, Visa and Google had in common that hard brain comparison, but I would tell you that they were very much exceptional in terms of the deal flow that you see in the IPO market, and I'll show you that momentarily. So on page 8, question becomes, again, why does it matter that the IPO market has slowed down dramatically? This is a quote that came out of the most recent, I hate to say, December 07, report to the president from the Small Business Administration. And the gist of it is this. For 2004, which, by the way, is the last year in which they have full data, to go back to that prior presentation about government's efficiency, firms or companies with less than 500 employees accounted for all net new jobs in the year 2004. They accounted for half of the private sector workforce and half of all non-farm private GDP. So the takeaway there is small firms are a big deal. Now, I still have to connect the dot. So what does that mean for the IPO market? If you flip to page 9, you'll see one of the charts that I showed you earlier. And there are a lot of statistics on the bottom of this chart. I think the most important one for this particular point is the median revenue. What we basically did is we went over the same time frame, we looked at all the deals, and you can see median offer size, and it changes over time, median market cap, and it changes over time, but median revenue and net income. And what you find is that while that number has varied over time, even as recently as 2007, the median revenue for companies going public was $59 million. And while $59 million, may seem like a lot of money, that's not really a big company in the grand scheme of things. So the message I would give you, and let me say one other thing. From a public equity investor perspective, small cap is $2 billion in value and down. So from a public equity investor perspective, the median deal was kind of a micro cap deal. So the key takeaway there is the public equity market, new issuance market, is a small cap market. And the importance of the market being available to being open is that if many of these investors who participate, not necessarily after the deal, but before the company has gotten to that level, to go public. If those investors don't see the exit path, they aren't necessarily going to be enthusiastic about putting their dollars on the table. And we're beginning to see that in a substantial way with respect to venture capital investors in particular. Page 10 attempts to connect these dots in another manner. It's a modified corporate life cycle. Basically reviews how companies develop from de novo startups through to that renewal or death phase where they're focused on branching out and doing substantial M&A or not. And importantly, what it highlights is the funding alternatives that companies may consider may be available to them at the various stages. We're all familiar with the idea of startups and people doing things in a garage based on what's in their checking account and their credit card. And maybe they've got a few friends and family who throw in dollars from an angel perspective. That really is equity. The early growth stage, after you've got a concept and you're trying to build up critical mass, This is where you may have some banks and finance companies who are showing interest at a certain point in time. But the fact is, you may also need to develop a material or a stronger equity base. And this is where venture capitalists in many instances come to play. The important thing, again, about those investors, if they can't find an exit, those equity investors, if they can't see their way to an exit, they're less enthusiastic about putting money on the table. So if you circle back to the title of this presentation, which was Losing the First Dollar, it's not the very first dollar, but it may be the first critical dollar that gives you the ability to say that you are a real entity and you have left stealth phase and actually have the ability to go out and pursue the market opportunity that you see. Put differently, if the IPO market is closed and remains closed as it is right now, you will see, and we are seeing this, fewer investors putting their equity dollars on the table. And again, this connects to the credit market, because if those equity dollars aren't there, the banks are not going to be enthusiastic about continuously levering up those companies. Page 11 reviews some of the implications of a long-term IPO market shutdown or slowdown. The fact is, owners aren't completely shut out. There are alternatives that they can consider. What you often see, and by the way, we've highlighted some of the implications here. The first step that most companies take if they don't have access to equity dollars or to bank capital, for that matter, is they slow down their growth and they just try to maintain where they are. The fact is, there are a lot of small businesses that live in this phase forever because the owners are just okay with it. And there's nothing wrong with that. The challenge is that if companies aren't growing aggressively, or in a thoughtful manner, I should say, you may find difficulty retaining your best employees. You may find yourself losing pace with the competition. And the fact is, if there's a more aggressive competitor out there, and it doesn't matter if you're a technology startup or if you're a bagel company, if there's a more aggressive competitor out there who can grow faster, achieve scale, get better cost of capital, you may find yourself on the short end of the stick and losing out. Owners can decide in the case of a longer-term IPO downturn to merge with a similar-sized partner. That definitely has the capacity to create a stronger entity that can survive the current environment for a longer period of time, and frankly, it might make the company more viable in the public IPO market. But there are a series of issues, whether they're valuation related, which tends to be the first thing that pops up in people's minds, but arguably even more importantly than valuation between the two entities is the political issue of who's in charge. If you've got two entrepreneurs or two groups of entrepreneurs trying to get together. So that often becomes a hindrance in terms of getting deals done. I noted the term of addressing synergies. Basically what that means is who's going to lose their job in a situation where there are redundant capabilities at both organizations. Again, that's a challenge to getting a deal done. Smaller companies can look for a larger strategic partner. That has become an increasing challenge today as the larger companies have turned inward, are trying to conserve capital, maintain their own business operations. I think that'll probably change a bit, but it hasn't changed for now. And frankly, because a small company owner then gives up control, may experience a change of culture, not always enthusiastic about going down that path. The final ongoing operating strategy that many of the small business owners think about is finding a financial partner. If you're large enough, beyond the venture capital operator, you may want to go to an LBO shop. The problem LBO shops are having today, no bank capital, they can't make the numbers work. So frankly, they don't have deals. They aren't doing new deals. They are inwardly focused on their existing portfolios. So the other alternative is to shut down. That's not something that you see happening very often, but it does occur. You tend to see if management teams aren't comfortable with those middle three alternatives, that they'll slow down. Importantly, particularly in the current economic context, is many of these alternatives need to lead to loss of employment for some material number of people and a slowing of the economic cycle. So if you go back to that small business report, you think about what the IPO market means and the fact that many of the people who are facilitating these companies, facilitating their growth with capital, want to find an exit strategy. This exit strategy has been taken away from them for some period of time and for a longer period of time than in the past, surrounded by a confluence of events that's much more dynamic than what we've experienced in the past. You see that the near-term implications aren't all that attractive for our economy. So page 12, though not optimistic necessarily, it is an effort to just outline some of my views on what it takes to get us away from where we are today back to a place where the IPO market is much more active and the equity market overall. None of these are rocket science, but I would tell you that the way these things are written probably simplifies the challenge that we're all facing, particularly the idea of finding a functioning credit market, because that is a multi-layered, extremely complicated challenge that it's going to take some time to get resolved. And by functioning, by the way, I don't mean fully functioning. I just mean that there has to be some sense of predictability for operating companies in terms of their capacity to raise capital and capital and maintain their ongoing operations. We've seen some of that in the high-grade bond market for the investment-grade companies because a substantial number of those companies have come out and done bond deals year-to-date. But it really needs to trickle down to smaller companies because, again, if you go back to that SBA report, small companies are really where the growth is happening also as it relates to employment. Important in terms of the functioning credit market. The next issue relates to consumer confidence. These things tend to follow one another. As credit markets improve, you'll see larger companies having more confidence in their ability, not just to employ, but to grow their employment. Consumer confidence only improves with employment, and with some confidence that you have better access to the credit market. That follows from the functioning credit market. The third point: improving corporate performance. A series of issues here. First and foremost, I think that we're probably in a place where there's oversupply across the economy. The example I've used with many people is just the number of car dealerships that you drive up and down the highway and see. It's unusual relative to other parts of this world, for instance, Europe, where you don't really see large car lots like you see here on 29. So there's a level of consolidation that probably needs to take place to improve corporate performance. And we're going to also need to see an improvement in consumer and corporate spending dynamics. Obviously, if the consumer is employed, if the individual feels like he or she has better access to credit, he or she will spend. Whether or not that's a great thing long term, different question. Just suggesting that that's part of the dynamic for improving corporate performance, which in this case means earnings performance. Because ultimately, that improvement in earnings performance is what will be necessary to get the secondary market trading at higher levels. Why? Because investors will be able to look at those corporates and say, not only is there greater absolute performance, but hopefully there's better predictability in terms of what we're experiencing.
from those individual companies. The other issue related to secondary market performance is more positive inflows to investors, which come from a series of sources, whether it's the individual retail investor, corporate investors, insurance companies, et cetera, et cetera. The fact is, I think that it's more important that companies be able to show those more predictable earnings results, positive trends. Frankly, even neutral trends would be an improvement from where we are today. Those are the steps, big steps, though they may be, that are going to be necessary to improve market sentiment and get us to success in the IPO market.